Well, I'm sheltering a little more. I think we have to redouble our efforts somewhat. More time at home, more time visiting people on Zoom and on the phone. And as many of the speakers have said, this is really the time to cultivate our bodhisattva practice. Being fully with the suffering of the world, and with the joyful heart of meeting the world fully and perhaps bringing liberation and transformation, which is our intent. I want to say some words, of bodhisattva practice that was sent to me in an article, which was a conversation between the Vipassana teacher Sharon Salzberg and the Zen teacher Angel Kyodo Williams. Sharon Salzberg was recalling a story she heard from a civil rights activist. Martin Luther King was telling this civil rights activist that she has to love everyone. And the response was, "Well, can't I just love people that are worthy of love?" And Martin Luther King smiled and said, "No, we have to love everyone." And of course, this is our bodhisattva practice, loving everyone, being intimate, not being separate, compassion, being totally, totally with the passions and the suffering of the people around us. And Angel Kyodo Williams responded to this story by saying, "You know, I hardly even like anybody, but I love everyone." And that's she was telling us about bodhisattva practice, carrying with us the mind and heart of that intimate connection with everyone. And, you know, liking is sort of our picking and choosing what matches our personality, you know, who likes the same jokes that we do, who likes the same restaurants we do. But our bodhisattva practice is not that kind of karmic picking and choosing who is just like us. Our bodhisattva practice is casting a wide net, an infinite net, a boundless net, and saying, I'm casting out love in all directions, and that's how I'm connecting with the rest of the world. And it's with that connection that we can make the transformations that need to be made. We put on our masks because we love each other. This is our bodhisattva practice of boundless love and transformation. I was hiking with a friend last week in Wilder Park, and the two of us really indulged in sharing the news stories that we've been listening to on the radio and on TV in our own houses. And it was an excited and sometimes angry exchange of sharing the news of the politics, sharing the news of the COVID numbers that keep going up, sharing the news of our racial divide, the wounds caused by the centuries of racism in America. And at the end of our exchange, we certainly didn't talk about the news the whole hike, but it was a catching up at the beginning of the hike. At the end, I had what I described as kind of a righteous anger, that was this solid, hot ball in my stomach that really, really kind of trapped me. No place to go with just that anger, with just holding on tightly to a fixed opinion. And, another writer, Ruth, I'll get it. I will have Ruth's full name. She is a Vipassana teacher. She just wrote a book called Mindful of Race. And she calls these concepts in our mind knots, like a tying a knot. And the knots prevent freedom, prevent movement, prevent transformation. And we have to be mindful when our mind has settled, has tied itself into this knot that limits its flexibility, that limits its movement, that limits the possibility of transformation. And so here, you know, both my friend and I were pretty agreeable to what was happening in the news and the world. But at the end, I just felt stuck. I felt that I had tied myself into such a knot. And this was something that needed to be relaxed, that needed to be untied, that this righteous anger prevents transformation, doesn't prevent the flow into wholeness, but really keeps me in one spot. Ruth King is her name. A perceptual knot is what she described in her article. A way of viewing the world that blocks freedom. And of course, this isn't our bodhisattva practice of love and transformation. This, you know, it's fun to play with the word love, because we know it on sort of the ultimate level as well as the conventional level. But I think both realms, it describes freedom and a dance. And this is what we should be cultivating rather than just getting tighter and tighter into a fixed idea of the way that police should be, the culture of police should be reformed, the way that that COVID virus needs to be flattened out in its infectivity. This is about transformation, about a dance, about the freedom to move in any direction. Untying those perceptual knots. Of course, there's plenty of times when I'm not feeling this open heart of bodhisattva connection. I'm not feeling love. Sometimes things are just too tough, and I do feel stuck. You know, worry about health, worry about this festering wound of racism, and how that healing will come about. I know many people are without work and really, really stuck in their pile of bills. I know some people have lost family members or are worried about other family members. So it's hard to feel that open-heartedness and freedom in those times. But this is where our bodhisattva practice can really come in handy. These periods of sadness, of worry, of frustration, of anger, can be mindfulness bells in the way that we've all learned mindfulness in the way that Ruth King teaches in her book. Can be mindfulness that, oh, this is suffering. And of course, the bodhisattva, that's where the bodhisattva arises, in the midst of suffering. Another Zen teacher, Judith Regeer, says that, calls herself an addict for the deep, meaning she likes to dive deep in her practice. She's addicted to going deep. And she says that meditation and sasheen are kind of her tools for addiction, because they both allow her to go deep. And this is where we have to go when we're looking at our own racial bias and saying, where does this live? When did this start? In what generation in my family tree did this start? This is a deep going that we're asking ourselves to do to heal these wounds. That takes this mind of transformation, that takes this mind and this heart of love that says, this body and mind, I love you, but let's help heal the world. So we use our mindfulness practice to say, oh, this is suffering. And we use our bodhisattva practice to arise in the midst of that suffering and say, now I want to really, really penetrate this bias. Now I want to really penetrate my fears. How can I use these bodhisattva practices of saving all beings, of connecting intimately, of being one, to transform the suffering that's all around us. Many of us know Mary Mosin from the Vallejo Zen Center. And she talked about bodhisattva practice. She says the bodhisattva knows non-self, that there's no inherent self or ego that separates us, that we're this flow of causes and conditions. The bodhisattva knows impermanence. The bodhisattva knows suffering because she's a human body and this body suffers with its sickness, old age, and death, its fears, its hatred, and this body knows how to transform the suffering. And when Mary Mosin is using the term, the bodhisattva knows these three things, this is really the biblical knowing, the real knowing it to the bones, the confidence of having cultivated that knowledge lifetime after lifetime and period of meditation after period of meditation, so that that knowing of the unity of no self and the compassion to recognize suffering and the wisdom to know impermanence is always right there on the front burner because of the effort and cultivation to develop that mind and heart. And we all know what those six bodhisattva practices are. And so this will just be a review so that we can, in the midst of this era of healing that we're in and staying at home and cultivating our bodhisattva heart, we can take on these six familiar practices and really know them, you know, in the way that Reverend Mary Mosin was telling us, was teaching us. So we've got one of our bodhisattva practices is generosity, the effortless exchange of what is needed, without a giver, a receiver, or a gift. This is real effortlessness, not from one person that's lucky to have something, that's able to give it to someone who isn't so lucky and needs something. This is a effortlessness. And I was thinking of when we're all working together. When we're all working together on Sangha Day at the Zen Center, and we might be weeding the yard, and the person next to you will say, do you have another weeding tool? I can't find my weeding tool. And you might say, oh, here's this one. Take mine. And there's an effortless to that. There's no gift. It flows pretty freely. There's no one who's lucky and someone who's unlucky. It's an effortless giving. And so can we have that kind of effortlessness when a nonprofit might send out an appeal for funds, or when someone asks us for the gift of time? Can you pick up something for me at the store? That kind of effortlessness, that kind of where our intention is to help each other out. Our intention is to be fully with each other and be harmonious. That kind of effortless giving and receiving. Another one of our bodhisattva practices is ethical practice, morality, the precepts. The precepts are really the conventional behavior that promotes harmony and unity and accord. Which in a larger sense is unity, oneness, intimacy, and love. But Buddha really wanted to spell out the top 10 things that separate us, that cause disharmony, that cause anger and frustration. So gossip might cause disharmony and separation. Taking too much, taking what isn't given, might cause anger and disharmony. And so we practice these and the eight other precepts, to realize our bodhisattva vow of unity, intimacy, and love, and dancing rather than separating into angry units, angry, distrustful units. So the bodhisattva, in her effort to practice love and harmony and intimacy, with this body and mind, practices our Buddhist precepts over and over. Patience. What a great thing to practice in these times. Sheltering in place, thinking, you know, I really need to get that steel-cut oats for tomorrow's breakfast. Let me just walk down to the food bin, and then to sort of sit back and say, well, you know, I can make do with the regular oatmeal for a couple more days. I want to stay as close to home, to keep people safe, to keep myself safe. I can settle in here. I can watch this desire for chewy, toothsome steel cut oats, but I can let that one go and settle into this mind and heart of harmony, of nice, soft oatmeal. And that'll do until I need a few more things and can do things a little more safely. So this, that was sort of a pleasant story of patience, but a lot of times we really have to keep our minds from pushing and pulling and complaining. And this is just saying, oh, there I am, tight and immovable, and nothing but separation. I'm separating myself out from all of those people who aren't doing it the right way, or are doing it too slowly, or aren't doing it in the same timeline that I think should be done. And so a lot of times patience, or the intention of patience will arise in that really tight feeling. And then what a relief it is to just sort of take a deep breath and occupy the whole space fully with all beings around us. In this dance, the line will move in its own at its own rhythm, and I'll be right in there harmoniously stepping with it. It was a saint in another religion who said that patience is its own reward, a real kind of relaxing of the shoulders and saying, I can be here. I can accept this fully, and because I know the truth of impermanence, I know that this is going to move in another direction, and I want to be open for any direction that this might move to. So patience is a great practice, and we get to do it so much. We have to practice vigorously. We have to practice with diligence. We have to have sustained energy for the era that we're in. We might be sheltering for months and months, and we need to bring the energy to shelter, the energy to plan our outings to the forefront for months and months. It probably will affect the way we do things for the rest of our lives. I think masks are going to be with us a long time. I think we're going to be making careful travel plans for a very long time. We need to keep this energy, this diligence, which is the fourth of the six paramitas. We need to keep this energy on the front burner. We're going to have to do very hard work to heal the wounds of racism. I vow to make great headway into healing in my lifetime, but I think the healing will go several generations. And we have to turn towards the healing of this deep racial wound and sustain the energy generation after generation. And this is our practice of diligence, now I'll practice patience so that my energy will be sustained for the long haul. Now I'll practice harmony so that the dance will go smoothly, because we're going to be dancing. We're going to be changing our steps. We're going to be changing our views. We're going to be changing our minds for generation after generation. And so the emergence of the energy for the next step has to be ready, bringing energy time and again to our lives, and the healing and the liberation of all beings is the practice of a bodhisattva. The last two meditation Judith Regeer says that her addiction to going deep is facilitated by this practice of meditation, of just letting the dust that clouds our vision settle moment after moment, so that our vision is clear, so that our mind isn't distracted by the shadows, by the thoughts, by the old habits, and we can rest in unity, rest in oneness, rest in not separation. Our heart opens up when it's not sort of guarding itself against an imagined other, against our fears. Our heart opens up, and this meditation lets us rest in our bodhisattva heart. And it allows us to cultivate our wisdom mind, this mind that lets concepts and distinctions go, let them fall away, so that we can have the mind that says yes, the mind that says, I practice wholeness. I practice abiding in harmony. I am so close to you that I don't see any difference. And this is our six bodhisattva practices that we can cultivate moment after moment, and definitely is arising in all of us during this time of great suffering. So maybe I'll stop here and we've been practicing meditation in this hour. We've been practicing great patience in more ways than one. Suzuki Roshi said that that our sitting practice is the practice of the precepts. So in this hour, we've been cultivating the practice of morality and ethics. We've been giving time for this important cultivation, for each other to check in with, to look and see who's here, to make sure that we're cultivating relationships here. And we've been practicing with great energy for the long haul. So if anyone has any thoughts about these bodhisattva practices or the practice of transformation and love, speak now. Rachel.
If hate is just as much a part of love as anything else, why should we practice love?
When we're practicing love and intimacy and harmony, we don't push away anything, but we then, you know, if an argument arises, the only way that rift can be fixed is with the mind, the bodhisattva heart, the bodhisattva heart of healing and wholeness. So hate then isn't seen as the opposite, but hate arises within wholeness. And when we can fully embody wholeness, we say, okay, let me get curious about this. How did this start? What can heal this perceived separation? And let me start that process. Does that make sense?
I'm not completely sure.
I'm equating love with wholeness. There's nothing else. There's nothing else. There's no other thing. And when a perceived thing arises within that, we meet it with wholeness, not with separation.
So I shouldn't practice hatred to get curious about love?
Probably not.
That's fair. Thank you.
May our practice of the bodhisattva perfections open our hearts and help us realize healing, oneness, intimacy, harmony. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.